The reading this morning is, in fact, a pair of poems from Rilke's The Book of Hours. The Book of Hours is a book of poems that Rilke wrote very quickly, and they are somewhat in an imaginary voice. He wrote these as if he was a monk, or as if he was a person who was able to live that kind of life of religious reflection all the time. And so many of them are a conversation with, sometimes he uses the word God, and sometimes he uses the word force, and sometimes he uses the word universe. And so you can use whatever language works for you, knowing that even in poetic language, we don't have the language to express that, I'm going to use his word, force that's in the world that we sometimes are aware of. You are not surprised by the force of the storm. You have seen it growing. The trees flee. Their flight sets the boulevard streaming. And you know the one whom they flee is the one you move toward. All your senses sing as you stand at the window. The weeks stood still in summer. The trees' blood rose. Now you feel at once to sink back into the source of everything. You thought you could trust that power when you plucked the fruit. Now it becomes a riddle again, and you again a stranger. Summer was like your house. You knew where each thing stood. Now you must go out into your heart as onto a vast plain. Now the immense loneliness begins. The days go numb. The wind sucks the world from your senses like withered leaves. Through the empty branches, the sky remains. It is what you have. Be earth now and even song. Be the ground lying under that sky. Be modest now, like a thing ripened until it is real, so that the one who began it all can feel you when that force reaches for you. And this translated by the same translators. I believe in all that has never yet been spoken. I want to free what waits within me so that what no one has dared to wish for may for once spring clear without my contriving. If this is arrogant, God forgive me, but this is what I need to say. May what I do flow from me like a river, no forcing and no holding back, the way it is with children. Then, in these swelling and ebbing currents, these deepening tides moving out, returning, I will sing you as no one ever has, streaming through widening channels into the opening sea. I was not here last week because I was in Western Massachusetts at Roe Camp, which is a Unitarian Universalist camp up in the high hills just where Massachusetts touches Vermont. And I was attending a workshop led by Joanna Macy. Some of you are nodding, knowing who she is, and some of you may not know that she is a woman who has been working in the environmental movement for as long as I've been alive. She's 86 now, living in Berkeley, California, with her daughter and grandchild, and still traveling internationally. she is a little carp who swam upstream and made it through the dragon's gate. Although, the truth is, and you know this, it doesn't work like that in real life. You don't just get through the dragon gate that one time and then you're good. You have to go through it over and over again. And that's what she has done. She got involved with the environmental movement and was puzzled by the fact that so many activists got angry with each other and got discouraged and gave up. And she was trying to figure out a way to give people more capacity to stay working together and to stay in the work. And she realized that what people really needed to do was grapple with those innermost feelings, which mostly we aren't allowed to in our culture. Grapple with fear and despair so that we can stay present for whatever is happening, and so that we can stand to stay present for each other. So initially, the work that she did was called despair and empowerment work, which doesn't really sound like the environmental movement at first, but that's what she was working towards. And over the years, that same work has turned into what she calls the work that reconnects. And some of her first actions were about nuclear waste storage. And she was involved in the protests at the Seabrook Power Plant here in 1977. A few of you who were involved with those protests may have stood beside her. Perhaps you were all there when 2,000 people occupied the plant site in 1977. Perhaps you remember that 1,400 of those people were arrested and refused to post bail, and so they were all in jail for a week. And that all of that protesting cost the company a lot of money in delays and legal fees, and that contributed to the second plant never being built. Since then, Joanna Macy and her husband have worked around the world with communities who have been affected by any of a number of ecological disasters, including Chernobyl. You may have been here in the spring when another person came and did some of the work that reconnects with us and told the story of the people of Chernobyl trying to live in that part of the world which is just drenched in radiation. And you may remember us going out onto the lawn and dancing the Elm Dance for them. The Elm Dance, which is one of their dances to express their deep connection to the trees around them. The trees which are now so contaminated that they can't go into them. But still, their spirits, their deepest selves are sustained by those trees which they can't go to. And so we danced for them. And you may remember that we danced that dance twice, once for them and once for our lives here, because they're both true and important. And that is the work that Joanna Macy does. Give people the space and the tools to look at what is actually happening. The good and the terrible, our own lives, and the lives around the world. She is clear that we tend to look away, and she helps us return our gaze. So after spending some time with her, I thought, I need to know a little bit more about Seabrook. I get that calendar. Most of you probably get that calendar. I'm not even clear what's in that calendar anymore, because I look at it and I think, well, it's bad luck to throw this away. Very rational thinking. So I'll just put it in this drawer here. And I think, well, let's see, I know which way I should drive if something goes wrong, and I call it good. So this week I went and read about it. I learned about the two circles that they draw around nuclear power plants, one that's the plume radiation exposure ring, which is the 10-mile ring. That's the one that if something happens, you'll breathe it in. You won't be able to get away from it. And then there's the 50-mile ring, which is if you drink or eat anything from that zone, if there's been an explosion, then you'll be exposed. Of course, we're in the 10-mile ring, and Boston is in the 50-mile ring. And Seabrook makes more electricity than Chernobyl, the plant that blew in Chernobyl, made. I don't know what that means about the amount of radioactive material that is available there and what it means, what it would mean if there was an accident. What I did notice this week that I mostly try to not think about is that the stakes are very high right where we live, the place where we breathe. The stakes are very high. And I mostly put it in the drawer and close it. Because what do you do? What can be done? And I don't, of course, have an answer to that question. But Joanna Macy says, being able to pay attention is part of the force that will make the change. And she had this same moment in her own life when she began to understand some of what would happen with nuclear materials, and then also realized that many of the people who are in leadership and who are using the materials don't fully understand the consequences, partially because we can't comprehend the time scale on which radioactivity works. I mean, people can do calculations, but we mostly can't think about the length of time that radioactivity is alive in the world. And so we don't. And she said at some point she realized that she needed to educate herself and educate other people so that they would have information. And she also realized quickly that she could not do that alone. For a couple of reasons. One, she couldn't stand it. She couldn't stand to look at the information by herself. But if there were other people in the room also trying to do it, she could stand it. And also, we think and learn better most often if there are other people who think about it a little differently and have access to different kinds of information. So she started these study action groups. They educated themselves. She knows a lot about radioactive material. It was sort of appalling to me, actually, how much she knew. But they moved fairly quickly to wrestling with their despair. And she has spent the rest of her life getting people together to educate themselves and to wrestle with their despair. And over the years, her scope has widened. She has taken on not just nuclear power, but the many, 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 many ways that humans are harming and destroying our planet and our fellow beings. Ways that we mostly look away from. If you happen to live in a nice pool down at the end of the stream, it's easy to think that it's safe. Meanwhile, the work awaits us. And as her scope of work enlarged, she started to look for more and more people to do the work with, more and more helpers for the work. And she started to lean on ancestors and on future beings. You know what a joy it is to have children in the room, to have a baby asleep in your arms. What a difference it makes to think about people who will go on. And she casts that out 7 generations and thinks about, what can I do now to help them? If I think about them being alive and well, what difference might I have made to get them there? Which just opens your thinking. And we'll spend more time thinking about that future next week, because it is a little hard to expand your mind out that far. But she also started to look for allies around her in the present moment, which is a great place to have allies, you may have noticed. And one of the people that she found, and was still quoting to us this past weekend, was the first head of the EPA, William Ruckelshaus. Some of you may remember William Ruckelshaus. And he was a man who said that we are heading into a time of revolution that is fully as transformative for humanity as the Neolithic era and the Industrial Revolution. I love it when people who are parts of government agencies say that we are heading into times of revolution, in which the nature of society will be fundamentally altered. And he said that in that Neolithic era, when people began to settle down and began to trade, that their sense of who they were and how they were connected to other people and what was of most value shifted entirely. And of course, the Industrial Revolution, something that we're more closely connected to in time. And so we're a little more aware of how mass manufacturing and colonialism, mining, and the transatlantic slave trade all changed our understanding of who we are, how we're connected to other people, what is of value in the world. So William Ruckelshaus and Joanna Macy and a few other people think that we are in another moment of that much change. That we are deeply embedded in it, and that it's hard to get a good perspective on it and to think about how we might shape this fundamental change in the world. A lot of people call it a lot of different things. Joanna Macy says that there are three ways to tell the story of what is happening in the world right now. The first way to tell the story is to call it something like business as usual, which she also calls the Industrial Growth Society. And it's the story that is the most obvious in the world. It is the story of profit being the most important deciding factor. The second story she calls the Great Unraveling. In this story, capitalism is faltering, and we witness the brutality that comes from that. Mass shootings, wars with waves of refugees, and the environmental costs. And the third story she calls the Great Turning. It is turning our minds and our efforts to a life-sustaining society. And she says this story is full of uncertainty and possibility and awakeness for each of us. She tries to be very matter-of-fact about it, to say, you choose which story you will put your energy and mind toward. They are all real. They are all happening. And we each get to decide which one is the one we'll be in. Of course, that isn't simple either. One day you can get solidly behind one story, and then the rest of the week you realize you're in another story. And then something happens in Oregon, and you're back in the unraveling. And so we work together to keep choosing which of the stories we're in. Joanna Macy says, in order to be able to choose, we need to spend a fair amount of time with our innermost selves. And she led us through a number of exercises, and I will share one of those with you briefly today. It is the practice of open sentences. I will read you these two sentences, the beginning of two sentences, and then we'll give you a minute to just sit with them and see what your mind offers you for the second half of these sentences. Mary will bring us out with a little bit of music after you've had a moment for reflection. There is no right answer. There is no correct answer for the second half of these sentences. No one will be checking your spelling or your grammar. The point is that these sometimes give you a chance to witness your own self. To be alive in this time of planetary crisis is hard for me. To be alive in this time of planetary crisis is hard for me. What I appreciate about being in a time of global crisis is that first Rilke poem I read you about the force of the storm. Joanna Macy speaks German, among other things that she does, and she had long loved Rilke's poetry and his access to both the darkness and the possible. But she could never find a good translation of that poem. So she contacted the premier translator of Rilke in the U.S. and asked if he would consider translating that poem, which he had never done, because she wanted her activist friends to have that poem. And he said, "Oh, you know, I'm not doing Rilke right now. You do it." And that, my dears, is your calling to find your piece of telling the story of the great turning.